In my experience, at every single level, even if you are new in your job and the most junior person on your team, you have a role to play in creating a more inclusive culture. You can do that by seeking people out and asking them questions. Then you also identify, you know, for yourself, what's getting in your way, what triggers you, what you don't like about how someone else communicates, how you're going to handle that without, you know, blowing things up.
This is Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. I'm your host, Dr. Cindy Pace, Vice President and Global Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at MetLife. Who has the power to make a difference? Can anyone be a leader? How do we work together now that the future is here? From our communication style to the way we connect with colleagues and lead teams, inclusion impacts our everyday lives. How do we practice inclusive behaviors and make ourselves better humans in the workplace? We've always believed that it starts with a conversation. Sally Helgeson is a prolific writer, thinker, and speaker. So this episode is unsurprisingly filled with examples and opportunities for self-reflection. As we go, I'll call your attention to these moments and invite you to pause and think about what Sally shared. When Sally first started writing, the only texts for women in leadership taught them how to lead more like men. Yes, you heard that right. And I'm going to call attention to it again when Sally brings it up in this episode because it's crazy. And Sally thought so too. And that's why she wrote The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership. She presents all the innovative ways women transformed leadership roles rather than adapting to traditional forms of leadership. But before we get going, one more thing. I tell all of my guests before we hit record to just pretend we're at dinner. I want the podcast to be casual and flow naturally wherever it's destined to go. In Sally's case, we both thought of the same dinner we had together several years ago.
I'll never forget that dinner. It was at Buca downtown.
Yes.
And I was astonished by the level of honesty that I heard from, it was all women, as I recall, just in terms of what they were dealing with and their willingness to talk about it. And I particularly remember it was a woman who worked at the Fed, I think. And she was talking about how she had a commitment to trying to get honest feedback for women of color because she felt that they were so often protected from that or people felt awkward. And I can't tell you how many times I've thought of her when I was writing Rising Together.
I remember that evening sharing with you, and you, first of all, for our listeners, Sally is an excellent facilitator of conversation. It's authentic, it's real. She creates a safe space where you can really be yourself. There were no airs at the table. Even though we had introduced ourselves, it's almost like people forgot what your title was, what company you represented. And it was a group of women, of multicultural women together in a room discussing what we were going through in this particular situation. I remember sharing, I had just published my first HBR, my first and only right now, but it's not going to be the last, HBR article on how women of color make it to senior management. And I was sharing with all of you how I was so excited about this opportunity, but the first set of comments were very, very negative. And I didn't know what to do. And I was sharing it with all of you how it made me rethink having that level of visibility. And Sally, I'll never forget what you did. You said, first of all, Cindy, you have a group of women here, and I want to share something with you that women tend to do. We don't ask for help. Who is in your community? What I want you to do is I want everyone in this group, I'm going to post about your article, and I want everyone at this table to post or go in, make a comment. And Cindy, your homework is to reach out to your community. You let them know what is going on and you ask for their support. And I did that. And right after that, the comments started coming in. Your post went out. It was one of the biggest acts. I don't even think I told you thank you enough.
I do remember, because I remember going in and commenting, and my two rules with comments, because I've been out there in the public eye for a long time, are number one, never read a negative comment ever. Never read it. And number two, bury it, which is what we did.
Yeah.
Bury it under a wave of positive comments, because you can't get rid of it. And I think that it's very important to remain strong behind our work. And when we're reading the negative comments, we start to question what we have put out there in the world, or just as you say, whether we want to be out in public representing a point of view that it has immense value. So I'm really very glad to hear that you remember it and that it proved to be helpful. And, you know, we overcome, I don't think of them as mistakes. I think of them as internal barriers. We shrink back from the visibility instead of thinking, okay, how can I engage people?
So I want people to know a little bit more about you, Sally. And you've shared this information with me before, but I would love to go back to what we call your origin story. How did you come to this work? What pulled you in? What was your starting point? Tell us more about how it all started. And then we'll talk about where you are now and where you're going.
Well, I had a background in journalism and in corporate communications. And in the 1980s, I was working in a number of corporate communications jobs, mainly as a speechwriter for the CEO or senior executives, whoever was entitled to have a speechwriter. And what I began, I worked for excellent organizations that were really good. But what I began recognizing was that women had some of the best strategic ideas that I was hearing in the organizations I was part of, but they weren't getting through. They had no route to get through. I would hear about them in what used to be called the ladies' lounge, where they'd have sofas out and they'd say, well, I think what we should do is this. But there was no way those stories got through. And I thought, you know what I want to do? I want to write a book that looks at what women have to contribute as leaders and as thinkers. Because at that time, practically everything during the 80s, this was in the late 80s, practically everything that had been written about women was advice, you know, just leave your values at home, you know, do what you can to lead like a man, you know, wear the suit, the bow tie, fit in no matter what you need to do.
Lead like a man? Did you all just hear what I heard? I'm so glad Sally stepped up and started writing.
I started studying some of America's best women leaders. And when that book came out, The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, still in print after 34 years, continuously in print, it was the first book that looked at what women had to contribute rather than how they needed to change and adapt.
Once Sally started writing, she didn't stop.
So I wrote a book called The Web of Inclusion, first time the word inclusion had been used in the context of organizations. And I was looking at it. How do you get these strategic ideas from people at every single level? And what was interesting is at that time, there was no connection between diversity and inclusion. It was a couple of years after that book was published, I started seeing, all these diversity and inclusion initiatives. It makes sense because when you have a diverse workforce, and this is the reality of the workforce today, you have people who are less likely to feel included because they do not have a history as being part of the leadership mainstream. So that began to move my work on two tracks, which was women's leadership and inclusive leadership. And that has remained for, you know, now really looking at almost 36 years.
Wow, Sally, that is a very insightful and interesting origin story coming to this work as a journalist. So rooted in truth, rooted in knowledge and facts, and then being able to transition into women's leadership development and now inclusive leadership development. How would you define inclusive leadership? And then, you know, the attributes, what would you say the attributes are of an inclusive leader? How will we know?
You know, I have a lot of leaders who say, how can I judge whether we have an inclusive culture? And I always say, it's actually quite easy. If your people talk about we, you have an inclusive culture. If they talk about you and the senior team and the organization as they, you're falling down on the job. But the characteristics that a leader will demonstrate in order to create an inclusive culture will, first of all, include an openness and curiosity to people at every level, people from very different kinds of backgrounds, trying to identify not just what they're contributing, but also what their potential is, because that's what often gets lost. So I think an inclusive leader is one who has an awareness that the whole culture needs to feel inclusive. It's not just the top leadership. So that requires thinking about how it's you're hiring, you're structuring, and how you're promoting people. And also what kind of criteria you have. Delta Airlines recently had changed their policy dramatically. They had a requirement that anybody who was even considered for a management position had to have a college degree. And they realized that a lot of the people who were best at frontline work and had the most insights into customer service were being shut out of the potential to be managers in customer service. So they changed that. That's thinking inclusively.
Mm-hmm. Great examples. So Sally, you are a successful best-selling author on a lot of fronts. I remember our first conversation about the female advantage and then, you know, talking to you more about vision and the different abilities that men and women have around vision, broad spectrum notice, right? I remember you talking about that. And now we've gone from that to, you know, you've talked about Web of Inclusion, which was a great book. I remember that. And now we're into this rising, how women rise, and now rising together. Why this book now?
Why this book now? I believe that I have a very strong commitment to diversity and inclusion, or DEI, however we're, you know, defining it. A very strong commitment to that. I have seen the benefits to organizations of strong and robust efforts. I've also seen them not be successful, D&I initiatives. And what I've observed is that either there's a certain lack of commitment from the top, which of course always shows, or the way they're rolled out isn't very skillful when it comes to enabling people to build strong relationships with those they may perceive as being different from themselves. That there's a lot of emphasis upon unconscious bias, surfacing unconscious biases, getting them out there, having people talk about them. But I thought, I want to take the whole issue of inclusion and building inclusive cultures on from a perspective of how. Number one, what gets in the way, like How Women Rise, what are the barriers to this?
Mm-hmm.
They need to be addressed. And then what are the behaviors that are most likely to create an inclusive culture at the team level, division level, at the organizational level?
Well, let's talk about that. Let's break that down a bit. You know, I also want to make sure that we cover the entire book title, Rising Together, How We Can Bridge Divides and Create a More Inclusive Workplace. So when we think about change, we think about impact, we think about culture, we know that it's created on several levels of the organization, as you've talked about, the individual, which is why we talk, the name of this podcast is Inclusion Begins With Me, because it has to start with the individual. And then, of course, we are not on an island by ourselves. We interact with people on a day-to-day basis. That could be in a team environment, formal or informal. And then there's management. And then there's management and leadership. We use the term people leaders. And then you have the broader organization. Let's start from the employee level. What can an employee do that would impact, like, bridging a divide and creating a more inclusive workplace?
In my experience, at every single level,
mm-hmm.
even if you are new in your job and the most junior person on your team, you have a role to play in creating a more inclusive culture. You can do that by seeking people out and asking them questions. You know, what's most important to you in terms of this project on our team? You know, where do you feel you have real talents that you can contribute? And how can I help you do that? When I see people who are junior doing that, I know one thing, that 10 years later, I'm going to see them in a significant role or on the track for that. Because it's taking that responsibility. That's why I love the name of your podcast, Inclusion Begins With Me. Yes, it does. You don't wait around hoping your leader gets the message and creates an inclusive culture.
This is my mantra for season 3 of Inclusion Begins With Me. Everyone has a role to play in making inclusive workplaces. We've talked about this throughout season 1 and season 2, but now I really want to call your attention to Sally's advice. Ask questions. Find out how you can contribute to DEI initiatives and make a plan for how to speak up when you witness non-inclusive behavior.
You also identify, you know, for yourself, what's getting in your way, what triggers you, what you don't like about how someone else communicates, how you're going to handle that without, you know, blowing things up, how you're going to handle it internally for yourself so that you can figure out an effective way to potentially make that person an ally. It may not happen. They may not be open to it, or they may not be open to it now. You don't want to close off those possibilities, because this is what leads to the kind of polarization that is basically serving nobody.
Great point, Sally. I want to go back to, what is the first step to building bridges? And I like this idea of building a bridge, offering someone or people the opportunity to connect beyond diverse perspectives and beliefs. So what is the first step? How do we do that? How do we model this, especially as you've talked about at this day and time where there's a lot of polarization and divisiveness, and we're not going to all agree. But we can agree that it's value in collaborating and working together. So how do we get past that point? What's the first step to building bridges?
As individuals.
As individuals.
In my view, the first step to doing that really requires a degree of self-awareness. So this is where the unconscious bias thing is important, but we don't want to get stuck there. So an awareness, you know, I mean, I'm just going to use an example that's
okay.
I don't like neck tattoos, for example. You can go, you know, that I was recently released from state prison look doesn't necessarily do it for me. But guess what? I have been in situations where I'm aware, I think, okay, this is just my own garbage. I'm going to treat this person like someone I respect. I'm going to listen to what they say. I'm not going to let my eyes run all over their neck or something like that. I'm going to be a respectful person and hear them out. And most of the time, you know, it ends up being a good conversation. I had that with a young woman who walked down the street. And then I'm thinking, why was I so hung up on neck tattoos? Who cares? It's not my business. It's not a big deal. So what? And we all have these things. But the important thing is to have an awareness of it and then just to think, okay, well, that's my stuff. I don't need to do that.
Do you all remember Risha Grant's advice about being better than our BS? This is a similar point. Consider your biases and places where you pass judgment and do better.
I don't have to buy what I'm feeling. I don't have to see what I'm feeling as the absolute truth. I can open myself to what was this person's experience. And that's the kind of, you know, you were talking at the beginning about the authentic conversations we were having at that dinner table that we went to, the dinner we had in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the example that you used in the beginning about all of us deciding and volunteering and showing up to begin posting positive comments on your article that would bury the negativity and the hate. So action is a part of it. The conversation, when it goes someplace, when it results in an action, that's what really builds that proactive alliance that shifts a culture.
So it takes action. The first step is probably the biggest step, because if you don't take the first step, then they're not subsequent steps to acknowledge. And in these examples, what was powerful about the two examples you gave using yourself as one of them is the acknowledgement of some of the action is personal, is self-awareness, really examining our own biases, our own belief system, and really critically examining them while staying open and actively listening to the experience of others. I think there's some neuroscience behind what you talked about. I'm not going to go into it. I'm not a neuroscientist, and it's been a long time since I studied neuropsychology. I did as a minor in undergrad. But that's an amygdala hijack when you have that immediate emotional response and memory, because that's our old part of the brain, that memory, and almost takes you out of the moment that you're in. It's almost like in that example, it was a traumatic experience that had not been tended to. And so it becomes, and we're going to talk about this, a trigger.
Yes.
And people get triggered, and we don't sometimes know what is going to trigger us. You know, the word is frequently used in pop culture. I would say, you know, people are becoming like psychologists without the training and using all kinds of psychological terminology, may not know what it means, but you chose to use it in Rising Together. why use that word, and what can we understand about our triggers?
I did use it very deliberately with an awareness of how it's used in pop culture and mm-hmm. a desire to sort of reclaim it as a word that could be useful to us. What you talked about with the acknowledgement, I use the framework sort of awareness, acceptance, and action. So acceptance is the part where we acknowledge, you know, you're like, oh, okay, I'm aware that I'm feeling this. I'm going to accept that I feel this. That's fine. But I'm going to take an action that doesn't necessarily, you know, I'm not responding to a trigger. So a trigger is situational. It's any situation. It's a person. You know, it can be words. It can be comments that stirs an emotional response in us. And, you know, that's the reality. It stirs that emotional response, but it is situational, which means that we cannot control it always because we cannot control our environment. And I think that especially in colleges, you know, with trigger-free zones and trigger warnings and all this kind of stuff, so-and-so was triggered when someone told them to read this, that, or the other book. This is resulting in a lot of problems in education right now. The idea seems to be that no matter who you are, that a school or university can create an environment in which no one will be triggered. This is never going to happen. People get triggered by circumstance and cannot control it. The more important thing is to learn how to deal with it when you are triggered.
Sally has an example of what to do when a trigger comes up at work.
This terrific woman I worked with who was a now quite senior executive in financial services with a really satisfying and rewarding career. And earlier on, she had co-run a pilot project with a male colleague, and she was the idea person, and he was this sort of operations guy who made it happen. But she was the idea person. She was the star. She felt that she was the heart and soul of that pilot project. And she could not believe when he was chosen to lead it. She said for the first 2 months, she had a very hard time working for him because she was so resentful. She felt the situation was so unfair. She said, you know, they were always promoting men. Here they had an opportunity to promote a woman who'd really done something valuable, and they didn't do it.
I think this is an example a lot of us can relate to. It's easy to become frustrated if we don't feel recognized for our hard work.
So she, rather than confronting him, she did something funny. She, you know, bought an apple pie and, you know, put a slogan on it in a way that would amuse him, put it on his desk. And they ended up eating it together. And he said, I think you got something to tell me because of the way she had approached it.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, yes, I do. I feel it was very unfair that you got that job. And I've been really, you've probably seen, I've been struggling to be a good team member. She said, because I cannot get past the resentment I feel that you got promoted. And he said, well, why do you think I got promoted? She said, you know, you're a white guy, you're a friend with this guy. And he said, you know, those things may play a role. He said, but I think that what they really wanted was a super operations person, not a creative thinker in this role. And that's why I got it. Let me talk about some of the reasons they told me that they were going to move me into this position. And he told her, and he said, now, does this sound like things that you want to do and get good at? Because if it is, I can help you with that. I can help you, you know, identify what skills I've developed that I think are helpful to me in this job. And I can help you get known for those skills as well. Is that something you would like? And she said, I thought about it and I realized it was not the kind of job I wanted at all.
I do want to point out that in some cases, your first reaction may be right. What Sally is doing here is saying, pause and consider other factors before reacting.
There may be other factors at play that I am not aware of. Let me investigate so that, you know, I can deal with this trigger myself before I go to the mattresses, blow the whole thing up, which is appropriate for some things. Absolutely.
Right.
Not saying that, but it may not be at that level.
Sally, this is such a powerful example. And I told listeners, I told you that Sally was going to find a moment to have a masterclass with us. This is so important, and it's a huge step for, I would say, healing our hearts and our minds. It can help our well-being. You know, if you're carrying around something that has traumatically triggered you to a point where you're not showing up as yourself, you're bringing negative energy into the workplace when you have been this person that was creative and or people enjoyed working with you, it's like you change the chemistry of the room when you are so involved. It's like you've turned inward and you can only see what's bothering you.
Yes.
So Sally, we are going to, you know, I could talk to you forever. And I think this is a great example. As we close out, I'd love to hear from you. What do you envision the working world going from here? Like, what can we do to move us across this bridge? Because we are working in very challenging times.
We are working in very challenging times, although the economy is becoming quite strong, which makes it easier to do these things when employees are needed. And I'll speak to it from the perspective of my own experience. And that is two things. First of all, I think women have had an enormous impact upon how we define excellence in leadership, which has changed completely and dramatically almost, except obviously there are instances where it hasn't. But since I got into the game, because as women have become more confident, as they've developed more solidarity among one another, and as they have, in more recent years, in the last 10, 12 years, become more conscious of the need to build alliances with men, I think women have been able to change the nature of leadership, even when it's male leadership. You know, you're looking at relationship building as a leadership skill. That was not true 30 years ago. It was considered a soft skill and not anything to do with leadership, et cetera. So I think a lot of that has been with women. And I expect that, you know, to continue and there to be less and less tolerance, except in certain corners of the venture capital community, perhaps, for real male misbehavior at senior levels. So I think that's one thing I foresee. Another thing I foresee is this. I do not think D&I is going away at all or anytime soon because of all this political pushback and people trying to score points and get scalps, et cetera, and blow things up. I don't see that because organizations recognize that the nature of the global talent pool is highly diverse and growing more diverse with every single year. And in order to attract the best talent, and especially in order to retain and engage it, they need to be skilled at doing diversity. They need to create inclusive cultures, which are the only kinds of cultures in which a really diverse workforce can thrive.
Well, thank you, Sally. It has been a pleasure to have you here. And we strongly recommend that you go out and pick up Rising Together. There's great tips on what to do. And we're going to get better. We are going to learn and we're going to get better with your help, Sally. So thank you for all of your research, your insights, and the approach, the different approaches in the book that you provide us.
This is wonderful. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Thank you all for joining me on this episode of Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter. You can learn more about Sally Helgeson and all of our guests at MetLife.com. At MetLife, we are committed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we believe making a difference in the lives of our customers, community, and the world around us is altogether possible. Learn more and join us at MetLife.com. The link is in our show notes. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Inclusion Begins With Me, Conversations That Matter, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. I hope you also take the time to rate and leave our show a review. Before we go, we'd like to thank our podcast partner, Human Group Media, who helped us produce this show. That's it for today's episode. I hope you join me in the next one.